Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, February 1st. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, MISD Central Office Still Deciding on Bad Weather Day Activation, by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD has not made a decision yet about whether a bad weather day will be activated later in the school year. The district stated, "Nothing set yet, and decisions on when missed days will be made up will be communicated when they are finalized." The Midland ISD calendar showed January 16th and April 7th as bad weather days. April 7th is the Friday before Easter. Between now and April 7th are the intercession week, February 13th to 17th, and spring break, March 13th to 17th. Any revisions to the school calendar require board approval, MISD reported Tuesday. We are in consultation with the Texas Education Agency to determine how many days will have to be made up. At this time, we know two bad weather days have to be used before we are eligible for missed school day waivers. Because we receive additional day school year, ADSY funding, we are trying to learn how many days can be used through the waiver process and remain eligible for that funding. Tuesday was the second straight day that Midland ISD canceled classes. Tuesday was a more normal cancellation, with the notice happening around 5:30 a.m. The school district took the rare action of canceling classes closer to 8 a.m. Monday, including after some students had arrived on campus, when inclement weather hit later in the morning. We realize that making the decision to close campuses while the school day had just begun was burdensome for families, and we offer our sincerest apology, the district reported. On Tuesday, Midland ISD already canceled classes for Wednesday. This article is entitled, "Veteran Realtor Super Optimistic About Housing Market," by Stuart Doreen. Higher interest rates are not keeping homes inside Midland County from selling for higher prices. That is according to the Texas A&M University Real Estate Center and realtor Victoria Prince, who has come back to the Midland area. Super optimistic is how the veteran realtor Prince described the market, with home interest rates higher than some would like, but plenty of houses under contract. $350,000 to $450,000 priced homes pretty much move, Prince told the reporter Telegram. Under that price range, it is difficult to find housing. The latest Texas A&M Real Estate Center seems to back up Prince of Victoria Prince & Company. A&M reported that the average home sold in December went for $369,074, which was more than December 2021 and November 2022. The median price for a home sold also jumped to $320,700. December was the 52nd straight month that the average price for a home sold in Midland topped $300,000, a streak that goes back to September 2018, according to the Texas A&M University Real Estate Center. December also was the 19th straight month that the median price for a home sold topped $300,000. Prince said last week there were 468 homes in Midland County on the market and 228 under contract. That shows things are happening, she said. Midland's home sales show inflated pricing compared to other West Texas markets, according to the A&M Real Estate Center, including a median price of $235,000 in Ector County, $240,730 in Lubbock County, $230,000 in Tom Green County, San Angelo, $228,700 in Taylor County, Abilene, and $262,500 in Randall County, Amarillo. Other Texas A&M Real Estate Center statistics from December report include 196 homes sold in December, less than the 228 in December 2021 and 204 in November 2022. 559 homes available at the end of the month, less than the 639 in November and the 604 in December 2022. 2.3 months of inventory, which was less than November, 2.5, and December 2022, 2.6. A&M also shows that the months of inventory in Midland is comparable to other West Texas communities. A&M shows a range of 1.7 months in Randall to 3.0 months in Ector. Midland and Odessa had shown more months of inventory than other large metropolitan areas around the region and state for most of 2022. The amount of business is enough to have Prince appreciate being back after stops in Colorado and Austin. Coincidentally, the A&M Real Estate Center showed Travis County was still home for the highest median price in the state, $520,000 in December. "Home is where I belong," Prince said. "These are my people." This article is entitled "Tipro: U.S. Oil and Gas Benefited Economy Despite Challenges" by Mella McEwen. A detailed study of the state of energy in both the U.S. and Texas has been released by the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association. The association offered its 8th annual analysis of national and state trends in oil and gas employment, wages, and other key economic factors for the energy industry in 2022. Despite facing a number of unique challenges, including supply chain bottlenecks, inflationary pressures, workforce shortages, and an adversarial federal policy environment, the U.S. oil and gas industry continued to offer significant economic support in 2022, said Judd Walker, chairman of Tipro and president and CEO of Enervest Limited, in a statement. According to Tipro, the industry supported a total of 948,943 direct jobs in the U.S. last year, with total direct and indirect jobs tied to the industry exceeding 19 million. The U.S. oil and natural gas sector paid a national annual wage averaging $120,665 during 2022, 74% higher than average private sector wages. Payroll in the U.S. oil and gas industry, meanwhile, totaled $114 billion, and direct gross regional product, GRP, was $854 billion in 2022, or approximately 3% of the U.S. economy. Oil and natural gas development, led by Texas operators, will play an important role in meeting growing global energy demand for decades to come, under any realistic scenario, added Walker. What does oil and gas mean for Texas? Texas led the nation in oil and gas jobs with 347,828 people employed in this industry. Approximately 37% of all oil and gas jobs nationwide were located in Texas last year. When incorporating direct, indirect, and induced multipliers for oil and gas employment, the industry supported a total of 2.6 million jobs in Texas last year. Texas was the leading state by employment in every single sector in 2022, with the exception of natural gas distribution, California. Oil and gas jobs in Texas paid an annual average wage of $139,061, 103% more than the average private sector job in the state. Texas had the highest oil and gas payroll in the country in 2022, $48 billion, with California coming in at a distant second, $11 billion, and then Louisiana, $7.6 billion. Oil production in Texas was 1.83 billion barrels in 2022. New Mexico had the second highest oil production with 534 million barrels, followed by North Dakota with 393 million barrels produced. Texas led the country in natural gas production, with a record 11.2 TCF produced in 2022, followed by Pennsylvania with 7.6 TCF. Texas had the highest rig count in the country in 2022, with an average of 380 active rigs. The number of rigs in Texas increased from 332 in January 2022 to 410 in December 2022. In 2022, total direct gross regional product for the Texas oil and natural gas industry was $322 billion, or 16% of the Texas economy. Once the typical multiplier for gross regional product is incorporated, the Texas oil and natural gas industry supported 40% of the Texas economy. The Texas oil and natural gas industry purchased U.S. goods and services in the amount of $264 billion, 82% of which came from Texas businesses. The Texas oil and natural gas industry paid a record $24.7 billion in state taxes and state royalty payments in 2022. This article is entitled "Worst of Icy Weather Expected to Arrive Wednesday," by Stuart Doreen. For the third straight day, Midland students will not be attending school. Mother Nature has been crafty enough to keep the typical hustle and bustle in Midland at bay for 2 days, and Tuesday afternoon, officials determined the National Weather Service isn't giving them options moving forward. The NWS reported Tuesday that Midland County is among those under a winter storm warning through Thursday. The warning, according to the NWS, calls for significant icing expected and total ice accumulations of 1/4 to 1/2 inch possible. Power outages and tree damage are possible due to the ice, the NWS reports. Travel could be nearly impossible Tuesday night into Wednesday. That is enough for wary school officials who already called off classes because inclement weather resulted in the early morning glazing of roads. The National Weather Service, at its afternoon briefing, indicated that icy weather will persist into tomorrow and that road conditions are expected to get worse overnight in the eastern Permian Basin, MISD reported during the cancellation announcement. The district reported that it will make a decision about Thursday after NWS's afternoon briefing Wednesday. Other events closed or canceled because of the wintry weather included a Midland College meeting to introduce a search consultant. The Midland Rockhounds also reported that the West Texas Sports Banquet has been moved from Wednesday evening to March 1st. Weather forecast. The National Weather Service is calling for a high of 31 degrees and a 90% chance of precipitation on Wednesday. Freezing rain before 3 p.m., then freezing rain possibly mixed with snow showers. While no snow accumulation is expected, new ice accumulation of 0.1 to 0.3 of an inch is possible. The chance of precipitation is 60% Wednesday night. The low is expected to fall to around 29 degrees, which was actually warmer than the high temperature on Tuesday. The high should climb into the upper 40s on Thursday. Travel. Across the region, the impact of inclement weather has been greater. The Department of Public Safety reported 42 crashes by noon Tuesday as a result of the winter weather affecting the greater Permian Basin area. DPS also stated that officials responded to a multi-vehicle pileup crash at the Interstate 10-Interstate 20 split near mile marker 185 in Jeff Davis County. DPS reported as many as 12 vehicles were involved with multiple injuries. Midland Police reported less activity on Midland roads with 10 minor crashes and 3 crashes with injuries prior to 10:30 a.m. Tuesday. The city also reported some delays and cancellations, mostly to Dallas, but Midland International Airport remained open Tuesday. Passengers should check airlines' websites for updates, the city reported. Closures and cancellations. Schools closed Wednesday. Midland ISD, Hector County ISD, Greenwood ISD, Trinity School of Midland, Midland Classical Academy, Midland Christian School, Hillcrest School, TLCA Midland, DEA Public Schools, UTPB Cahoma, Midland College, all of Middle County locations. Midland Health, DIA Legends, start at 10 a.m. Wednesday and Thursday. DIA West, start at 10 a.m. Wednesday and Thursday. DIA Maine, start at 10 a.m. Wednesday and Thursday. DIA Permian Cardiology, closed Wednesday, 10 a.m. start on Thursday. The Breast Center, start at 10 a.m. Wednesday and Thursday. MRI Legends, start at 10 a.m. Wednesday and Thursday. MRI Maine, start at 10 a.m. Wednesday and Thursday. MRI Abel Hanger, closed Wednesday and Thursday. Midland Health Outpatient Pharmacy, start at 1 p.m. Wednesday and Thursday. Government and others closed Wednesday. The West Texas Food Bank is closed. The Midland County Courthouse is closed. City of Midland offices are closed. This article is entitled, MCAD, Weather Closure, Change to Property Tax Deadline, by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. The offices of Midland Central Appraisal District will be closed to the public on Tuesday and Wednesday because of extreme weather. The closure, according to MCAD officials, means the deadline to pay property tax will be extended to Thursday, February 2nd. The normal deadline to pay property tax in Texas is on or before February 1st of each year, MCAD officials said Tuesday. However, due to the closure of the office to the public, the deadline to pay property tax without penalty and interest will be extended to Thursday, February 2nd, 2023. MCAD officials told the Reporter-Telegram that Section 33.011A of the Texas Property Tax Code allows waiver of penalty and interest resulting from, quote, an act or omission, unquote, caused by the appraisal district. Taxpayers paying their property tax in person on February 2nd will not be charged penalty and interest, MCAD reported. In addition to paying in the lobby, payment may be made online via the district's website, according to MCAD officials. Taxpayers may also send payment by U.S. mail. The appraisal district also has a secure drop box located near the front door of the building for after-hour payment. The Midland Central Appraisal District's mailing address is P.O. Box 908002, Midland, Texas, 79708-0002. The offices are located at 4631 Andrews Highway. The website address is www.mid-cad.org. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Exxon Reaps $59 Billion Profit, Holds Buybacks, by Kevin Crowley, Bloomberg. ExxonMobil Corporation reaped a record $59 billion profit, but disappointed some investors by holding the line on share buybacks. Full-year profit, excluding one-time items, jumped 157% from 2021, far exceeding the driller's prior record of $45.2 billion in 2008, which at the time marked the biggest in U.S. corporate history. Chief Executive Officer Darren Woods said Exxon is harvesting the rewards from fossil fuel investments in recent years that were panned as ill-timed. The stock was up more than 1.8% at 3:14 p.m. New York time after dropping earlier in the session. Exxon's results followed those of U.S. rival Chevron Corporation, which posted a surprise earnings miss last week, just days after announcing a mammoth $75 billion share buyback program. The five so-called supermajors are swimming in cash after a record 2022. But pressure is mounting on executive teams to satisfy competing demands, investor appetite for bigger payouts, and buybacks versus political outrage over windfall profits during a time of war and economic dislocation. Exxon expanded buybacks multiple times last year and pledged to repurchase $35 billion of stock through 2024. Unchanged from previous guidance, the company is pursuing a balanced approach to buybacks and dividends while reducing debt and investing in new projects, Chief Financial Officer Kathy Mikells told analysts during the call. She gave no indication that Exxon will be increasing buybacks soon. This article is called Commentary. It is entitled, Drilling on Federal Land is the Oil Industry's Gas Stove Moment, by Liam Denning, Bloomberg. A month in, the biggest U.S. energy story of 2023 concerns something that accounts for an infinitesimal share of actual demand. Gas stoves. Fresh from going to the barricades for freedom flames, House Republicans have seemingly stuck to the margins in their next campaign. They just passed a new bill targeting the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, from which President Joe Biden drew heavily last year to counter the oil price spike sparked by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The legislation would seek to curb the president's ability to release SPR barrels and tie any release to a corresponding increase in the percentage of federal areas opened up for drilling. It is the latter that, as with those gas stoves, thrusts a relatively minor player into the spotlight. Intersection, an energy-focused data visualization firm based in Houston, has dissected the numbers extensively for energy production on federal lands and waters. The big takeaways are: as with oil and gas production in general, federal area output is close to the peak observed just before the pandemic. Federal areas account for only about 1/6 of U.S. production. Within those data, onshore oil production is the most pertinent metric because that is where the shale basins are and, therefore, where producers are likely to react quickest to any incentive to drill. In data going back to 2003, output crossed above 1 million barrels a day for the first time during Biden's tenure. And while it has declined somewhat since last summer, that coincides with a decline in oil prices. No conspiracy needed. Moreover, as Intersection laid out in analysis published in September, roughly 7 out of every 10 barrels of oil produced onshore on federal lands comes from just 2 counties in the entire country, Lee and Eddy in New Mexico. And between 2010 and 2020, while oil and gas companies leased about 15 million new federal acres, they allowed leases on 34 million to expire. In short, if your concern is raising U.S. oil and gas production further, the action is overwhelmingly on private and state lands, not federal acreage. Even leaving that aside, linking releases from the SPR via some mathematical formula to leasing more federal land, as the House Republicans' bill would mandate, doesn't make sense if your concern is replenishing barrels quickly. There is little correlation between the size of leasing programs and production, which makes sense because leasing is only the first of many steps in appraising a resource and then deciding whether and when to develop it. If Congress is concerned with refilling the SPR, codifying the repurchasing parameters put forward by the Department of Energy last year would be a useful outcome. This would send a clearer signal to producers about the SPR's role as a source of incremental demand when being refilled, in part by limiting the White House's scope to move the goalposts. All that said, one of the frustrations underlying that House bill is reality-based, namely the Biden administration's slow-rolling new oil and gas development. That is one reason Senator Joe Manchin forced mandated lease auctions into the Inflation Reduction Act in exchange for his vote. Indeed, last year's SPR draws to mitigate a sudden spike in energy costs demonstrated the tension inherent to the energy transition. Making sure supply is adequate even as the underlying system is overhauled, thereby discouraging some investment. While there is a school of thought that says choking off fossil fuel supply will force change, politicians espousing it may find change comes for their jobs first. Biden seems to get that, if his SPR releases are anything to go by. Yet he is also constrained by the demands of his green agenda and evident antipathy toward the oil industry, which he accuses of gouging, even as he also blames Moscow for high prices. It is argued by some that this in itself constrains U.S. production. The energy transition, by its nature, does act as a brake on investment in oil and gas, particularly longer-dated projects, and is gathering pace regardless of Biden's utterances. This article is entitled Gas Supplies Flow Through Second Day of Winter Storm Mara by Mella McEwen. Permian Basin oil and gas operators have weathered a second day of icy roads and frigid temperatures. The winter storm, named Winter Storm Mara, is being tracked by the Railroad Commission. The Railroad Commission of Texas's preparations for Winter Storm Mara began well ahead of time, as we began tracking the approaching weather last week, activated the RRC Emergency Management Team on Sunday on the incoming impact to the state, the agency said in a statement updating the status of the state's energy supplies. Agency staff has met daily with gas utilities serving residences for the last 3 days and held conference calls Tuesday morning with those utilities as well as the state's major oil and gas producers and pipeline operators. According to the commission, all facets of the gas supply chain, production, pipeline transportation, and underground gas storage are reporting no major issues. Preliminary estimates from the S&P Global indicate daily production of 25 billion cubic feet. Gas supply remains steady throughout the supply chain. Operators are dealing with icy road conditions in several parts of the state that could affect movement of crews and equipment, and the RRC is working directly with state and local partners to address those issues. Agency officials want to remind operators and all Texans to be mindful of road conditions and stay safe. Energy Transfer LP said in a statement its operations have not been impacted by the weather. Corporate officials said they have been preparing for the cold weather for the last several days by moving in additional personnel and equipment to ensure its system would continue operating without impact. Despite the frigid temperatures, and more expected in February, the cold snap is expected to only modestly impact supply balances in the coming weeks, according to the analyst Aid Allen with Rystad Energy. Allen wrote that the overall narrative recently has been one of mild weather, low prices, and healthy storage inventories, and recent weather projections have shifted that narrative somewhat. Market participants are keeping an eye on South Central storage, and specifically salts storage, within the region, Allen explained. Last week's storage in that region was 17.4% above the five-year average, presenting a bearish scenario amid expected growth in regional supply and tepid short-term forecast for regional demand. We expect short-term supply to ebb modestly, but based on the recent forecast for cold weather in early February, supply disruptions could impact Bakken and Appalachia flows in the coming weeks, Allen wrote. Still, on a forward basis, the outlook for prices remains skewed to the downside. Even with the recent forecast for a cold blast in early February, we foresee Henry Hub prices struggling to find upward momentum. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, February 1st. James E. McKinsey, Jr. James E. McKinsey, Jr. passed away unexpectedly January 29th at his home in Lubbock. James was born June 25, 1948, in Kermit, to James and Daisy McKenzie. James was preceded in death by James McKenzie, father, Daisy Stone, mother, one uncle, and five aunts. He is survived by his wife, Kathy McKenzie of Lubbock, son and daughter-in-law, Bandy and Brandy McKenzie of Midland, two grandsons, Bandy John McKenzie of Midland and Bryce McKenzie of Midland, also many nieces and nephews. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Karen Adams, July 11, 1953 to November 15, 2022. Karen Sue Newcomer Adams passed at home on November 15th after a battle with breast cancer. Born July 11, 1953 in Granbury to Horton Lee and Sue Adams, Karen was raised and graduated in Midland, moved to San Antonio, then Austin for years. Karen is preceded in death by her parents, son Ron Domstead and brother Daniel Adams. Left to honor her memory is her daughter, Gina Adams, granddaughters Alex, Cara, and Savannah Pendino, brother Lee Adams, sister Debbie Offield Freeman, and much extended family and friends. Karen's celebration of life / margarita party will be on February 4th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the VFW Post 7208, 1306 East Taylor Avenue in Midland. Donations may be sent to AM Breast Cancer or God's Fellowship Church in Midland. Martha Dunham, October 19, 1948 to January 29, 2023. Martha Lawler Dunham, 74, passed away January 29th in Graham. Funeral services will be held Saturday, February 4th at 1 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church in Graham. Burial will follow in Pioneer Cemetery. A family visitation will be held Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. at MacMillan Satterwhite Funeral Home. Martha was born on October 19, 1948 in Laredo to the late W.D. and Lola Lawler. She married Joseph L. Dunham, her husband of 23 years, on January 2, 2000. Survivors include husband Joe of Graham, daughters Martha Jo Bailey of Magnolia, Nicole Dunham and Janet Jacobs of Tom Bean, sons Kevin Dunham and wife Gay of Sydney, Joseph Dunham Jr. and wife Rosa Melita of Odessa, granddaughters Amanda Payne and husband Jay, Andrea Rumbaugh and Jasmine Dunham. She was preceded in death by sister Clota K. Martin. Memorials may be made to the Young County Humane Society and First Presbyterian Church. Death notices. Ashley Whittenen. Ashley Whittenen, 36, of Stanton, passed away January 30th. Her family will have a service at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home of Midland, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Joseph Hosey Edward Belden. Joseph Hosey Edward Belden, 94, of Midland, passed away January 26th. A rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. Friday, February 3rd at Nallie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 4th at St. Anne's Catholic Church. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Michael R. Glenn. Michael R. Glenn, 73, of Midland, passed away January 29th. Celebration of life service will be held in early February. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Wilma Eugene Howell. Wilma Eugene Howell, 99, of Midland, passed away January 29th. There will be no service. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Hi, this is Bailey reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, February 1st. Brutal weather likely to continue. Editor's note, an early print deadline due to the weather means this story may not be the most up-to-date. Tuesday marked a second cold weather day for Ector County ISD students, and that weather impacted traffic around the Permian Basin. School will remain closed today. Temps in the low 20s and some precipitation overnight on Monday left roads treacherous in the early morning hours. Today's forecast is not much better, with the National Weather Service indicating that more precipitation, including a small snow possibility, could leave drivers this morning facing rough roads for the third day in a row. ECISD issued an email to parents and teachers in the afternoon indicating school will be closed again today. On Monday night, the district detailed that a two-hour delay was the plan for school Tuesday. However, by 6 a.m. Tuesday, the decision was made to cancel school after black ice and other rough road conditions made travel precarious. UTPB and OC, as well as the city of Odessa and Ector County, also shut down for the second day in a row. UTPB and OC had already announced plans to stay closed today. Ector County offices will remain closed as well. The OA will post other closings as quickly as they come in. Medical Center Health System had a two-hour delayed start on Tuesday and plans to do the same today. Scheduled surgeries and procedures are not affected by the delay. The National Weather Service in Midland detailed that the bulk of the freezing rain is expected overnight Tuesday through this morning. Many locations will remain below freezing until late in the afternoon, while portions of the Permian Basin may not get above freezing. Significant icing is expected and travel will be extremely hazardous, the NWS website detailed. The roads are also hazardous Tuesday morning, with the Texas Department of Public Safety reporting a crash near the Interstate 10-Interstate 20 split involving roughly a dozen vehicles and multiple injuries. Travel in West Texas is discouraged at this time due to icy roadways, Sergeant Stephen Blanco said in the release. By Tuesday afternoon, the NWS was predicting that overnight Tuesday would be almost a carbon copy of last night, with freezing drizzle developing across the eastern Permian Basin that will slowly spread west and intensify overnight. This morning's temps are expected to be in the 20s. A light glaze of ice is once again expected through late morning, and a winter weather advisory for all of the Trans-Pecos and Permian Basin is in effect. Heading into this afternoon, the upper level trough begins to move overhead. Temperatures may warm to just above freezing for much of the region, allowing for a changeover to normal rain during the afternoon and evening before temperatures fall heading into tonight. In Odessa, the Salvation Army was housing a couple dozen people and plans to keep the shelter open today during the day and night as well. Salvation Army's officials were seeking donations of food and snacks to help feed those who were staying at the shelter. Want to help? Call 332-0738 or visit the shelter at 810 East 11th Street. Newly renovated ORMC Almost Ready to Go by Ruth Campbell. After more than 2 years, the newly renovated Women and Children's Center at Odessa Regional Medical Center is ready to go. The project, which began in the middle of the COVID pandemic, cost nearly $20 million and transformed the original building constructed in 1975. All the patient areas and rooms were renovated to create an inviting environment for patients and their families. They added a 7-bed obstetrical emergency department to care for moms who need emergent care during their pregnancy. The area also includes 2 separate operating rooms and additional support space. President Stacy Brown said they don't have an exact opening date yet. They are recruiting for a few open positions, so it will open after they have hired and complete their orientation. For now, the obstetrics emergency department is being operated in the labor and delivery area until the new space is fully staffed. It will be staffed by a board-certified obstetrician. There is also a place for the physicians to sleep. There also is a procedure room they can expand into. The lobby and registration space has also been updated to be more accommodating to patients and visitors. The Secret Garden gift shop and coffee shop will open in the next few months. The 150,000 square foot area now features modern decor, higher ceilings, and is lighter and brighter. We thought that it would be about a year to 15-month project, Brown said. It ended up being over 2 years. The hospital started as a women and children's facility. From that time forward, Brown said she believes it has undergone 3 expansions and multiple renovations. This project was focused primarily on the patient-facing areas, Brown said, such as patient rooms, the lobby, and the new obstetrics emergency department. The 7-bed obstetrics emergency department is repurposed space that ORMC previously had, but it was vacant. We're really proud of the aesthetics of it all. The color scheme is totally different. Our goal was to make it very comforting and inviting for our patients and families, Brown said. We recognize that the birthing process can be stressful as it is, and we wanted them to be able to have an environment such as this that puts them at ease and makes them feel comforted, Brown said. Brown said the admitting area was renovated as well. The new space also offers a lot of nice seating and Wi-Fi connection so people can charge devices while they wait. Chief Nursing Officer Carol Cates said the raised ceilings are what strikes her about the renovation. They also took out a yellow casing around the door that seemed to take a lot of light out of the space. They opened so much of this up by raising the ceilings, changing the entrance, and adding more glass. Even with the lights off in here, it's so much lighter and brighter. It's not just the paint that went into all of that. It really was about making it peaceful and calming and spacious. When you build a new building, our modern architecture is so open. That's easy to do. But with a 50-year-old building, that's not so easy, Kate said. The architects, to me, really were able to do that in this lobby, and I still can't believe it's the same building. The project architect was JSA Architects, which has worked with the hospital for decades, and Brown wanted to give a shout-out to Jay Bradford for his work on the project, Brown said. The construction firm was Tynert Construction of Lubbock. This is the first time we've worked with Tynert, and they were fantastic partners during this process, she said. The age of the building is one reason the project took longer than initially anticipated. A special thanks to Steward Healthcare, our parent company, who supported us in this and made sure we got the funding to be able to do the renovation. It was initially budgeted at almost a $17 million project, but the price tag came close to $20 million once it was all said and done, Brown said. Without Steward's support on that, we would not have been able to get it done, so we're very grateful for that support. When they started the renovations in June 2020, the COVID pandemic had just begun. Hospitals were shut down and they were not doing any elective surgeries. There wasn't a lot going on anywhere, except for emergencies and COVID. It hadn't really hit here yet, so we weren't really experiencing that aspect of it. But the shutdown part of it, we were, and the concerns with volume and the financial impact of it all was very prevalent in the hospital industry for sure. But we never missed a beat. We weren't delayed a day in terms of what we were supposed to start, Brown said. Complaint filed against former city attorney by Kim Smith. Odessa City Council member Denise Swanner has filed a formal complaint with the Texas State Bar accusing former city attorney Natasha Brooks of backdating fellow city council member Steve Thompson's conflict of interest forms. Swanner filed the complaint Monday at noon through the bar's online grievance procedure. She wrote, Ms. Brooks' appointment as the city attorney for the city of Odessa was recently terminated and a new interim city attorney was appointed by city council. Upon his appointment, the interim city attorney discovered evidence that several official forms had been backdated by city staff under the direction of Ms. Brooks in her capacity as city attorney. The interim city attorney began an investigation, and he obtained sworn affidavits from the city secretary, a notary public in the city legal department, and from Mr. Steve Thompson, a sitting city councilman, detailing how Ms. Brooks had instructed them to backdate a conflict of interest disclosure from Mr. Thompson after a local reporter had requested the disclosure form. Swanner attached Thompson's affidavit on the matter. Claire Reynolds, public affairs counsel for the Office of the Chief Disciplinary Counsel, said she couldn't confirm a complaint had been filed. Disciplinary matters are confidential unless they result in a public sanction or are filed in the district court, she said via email. A message left on the phone number listed for Brooks on the complaint was not returned. Brooks and city manager Michael Moreno were terminated without explanation December 13th by a 5-2 vote of the Odessa Council. It was revealed last week, however, that in late December, City Secretary Norma Aguilar Grimaldo and Notary Public Legal Assistant Nara Enriquez both signed affidavits stating that on December 9th or December 10th, 2020, Brooks instructed them to either file stamp or notarize a conflict of interest disclosure statement signed by Thompson with a December 8th, 2020 date. According to Texas law, it is a misdemeanor crime for a notary public to backdate documents and that there is a 2-year statute of limitations. In an interview last week, Thompson said he was instructed to sign the backdated affidavit by Brooks, but he also said interim city attorney Dan Jones was present as well, which contradicts Swanner's version of the events. He said he thought other attorneys were there, too, but could not recall whom. Other sources who requested anonymity also confirmed Jones was in the room, as were two other attorneys. Thompson said he was told it was okay to sign the document because he had informed Moreno about his association with STA benefits in the fact on December 8th. When Jones showed him the recently signed affidavits from the city staff members, he was shocked, he said. He signed the affidavit on Brooks's advice in the presence of other attorneys, but he had no idea Brooks would instruct city staff to backdate documents, Thompson said. She's a city attorney. She's my attorney. Okay, so I'm leaning on her advice, Thompson said last week. I trusted people. I trusted people who were supposed to know. It was the first time I'd been involved in politics like this, and I'm following her lead, and she's supposed to be keeping me out of trouble, Thompson said. Thompson said he signed another conflict of interest disclosure form at Brooks's request on December 11th, 2020. District Attorney Dusty Gallivan said he could neither confirm nor deny his office has been asked to investigate the backdating of the disclosure forms. Thompson said he was newly elected council member at the time he signed the affidavits. On December 8, 2020, city staff placed on the consent agenda a contract with the Stanford Insurance Company for group life insurance, AD&D coverage, and retiree life insurance. Standard Insurance had been recommended to the city by STA Benefits, an insurance brokerage firm that had a contract to find insurance companies for the city of Odessa. Minutes for the meeting showed Thompson abstained from the vote, saying he used to own STA Benefits and his son was the current owner. Then Mayor David Turner and then council members Michael Shelton, Detra White, Tom Sprawls, Mary Willis, and Peggy Dean approved the contract. On December 14, 2021, Standard's contract, which was again on the consent agenda, was renewed by White, Sprawls, Willis, Mayor Javier Hoven, and Denise Swanner. The minutes show Thompson again abstained. In January 2022, Odessa Development Corporation board member Jeff Russell was removed from the board by a 4-3 vote by the city council because there had been allegations made by Thompson that Russell had discussed an item despite having a conflict of interest. President Biden to end COVID-19 emergencies on May 11th. The Associated Press, Washington. President Joe Biden informed Congress on Monday that he will end the twin national emergencies for addressing COVID-19 on May 11th, as most of the world has returned closer to normalcy, nearly 3 years after they were first declared. The move to end the national emergency and public health emergency declarations would formally restructure the federal coronavirus response to treat the virus as an endemic threat to public health that can be managed through agencies' normal authorities. It comes as lawmakers have already ended elements of the emergencies that kept millions of Americans insured during the pandemic. Combined with the drawdown of most federal COVID-19 relief money, it would also shift the development of vaccines and treatments away from the direct management of the federal government. Biden's announcement comes in a statement opposing resolutions being brought to the floor this week by House Republicans to bring the emergency to an immediate end. House Republicans are also gearing up to launch investigations on the federal government's response to COVID-19. Then, President Donald Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary, Alex Azar, first declared a public health emergency on January 31, 2020, and Trump later declared the COVID-19 pandemic a national emergency that March. The emergencies have been repeatedly extended by Biden since he took office in January 2021 and are set to expire in the coming months. The White House said Biden plans to extend them both briefly to end on May 11th. An abrupt end to the emergency declarations would create wide-ranging chaos and uncertainty through the healthcare system for states, for hospitals and doctors' offices, and most importantly, for tens of millions of Americans, the Office of Management and Budget wrote in a statement of administration policy. More than 1.1 million people in the U.S. have died from COVID-19 since 2020, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, including about 3,700 last week. Congress has already blunted the reach of the public health emergency that had the most direct impact on Americans as political calls to end the declaration intensified. Lawmakers have refused for months to fulfill the Biden administration's request for billions of more dollars to extend free COVID vaccines and testing. And the $1.7 trillion spending package passed last year and signed into law by Biden put an end to a rule that barred states from kicking people off Medicaid, a move that is expected to see millions of people lose their coverage after April 1st. In some respects, the Biden administration is catching up to what a lot of people in the country have been experiencing, said Larry Levitt, the executive vice president for health policy at Kaiser Family Foundation. That said, hundreds of people a day are still dying from COVID. Still, some things will change for Americans once the emergency expires, Levitt pointed out. The cost of COVID-19 vaccines are also expected to skyrocket once the government stops buying them, with Pfizer saying it will charge as much as $130 per dose. Only 15% of Americans have received the recommended updated booster that has been offered since last fall. NFPA urges caution when using home heating equipment. The National Fire Protection Association issued a press release Tuesday urging the public to use added caution when heating their homes during the winter months when nearly half, 46%, of all U.S. home heating equipment fires occur. Home heating equipment is the second leading cause of U.S. home fires and home fire injuries and the third leading cause of home fire deaths and direct property damage. According to the latest home heating fires report from NFPA, an average of 44,210 home heating fires occurred each year between 2016 and 2020, resulting in an estimated 480 civilian deaths, 1,370 civilian injuries, and $1 billion in direct property damage. Home fires caused by heating equipment were less likely to occur in the overnight hours from midnight to 6 a.m., 13%, but they accounted for more than 2 out of 5 fatalities, 43%, as well as disproportionate share of injuries, 22%, and direct property damage, 20%. Space heaters are most often responsible for home heating equipment fires, accounting for one-third of the fires, as well as the vast majority of associated deaths, 88%, and injuries, 80%. NFPA offers three tips and guidelines for safely heating your home during the winter months. Heating equipment and chimneys should be cleaned and inspected every year by a qualified professional. Keep anything that can burn at least 3 feet away from all heating equipment, including furnaces, fireplaces, wood stoves, and space heaters. Always use the right kind of fuel, as specified by the manufacturer, for fuel-burning space heaters. create a 3-foot kid-free zone around open fires and space heaters. Make sure space heaters are in good working order and use in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions. Turn portable heaters off when leaving the room or going to bed. Fireplaces should have a sturdy screen to stop sparks from flying into the room. Ashes should be cool before putting them in a metal container, which should be placed outside at least 10 feet away from your home. All fuel-burning equipment should be vented to the outside to avoid carbon monoxide poisoning. If you smell gas in your gas heater, do not light the appliance. Leave the home immediately and call your local fire department or gas company. Make sure smoke and carbon monoxide alarms are located throughout the home. Test them monthly to ensure that they're working properly.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.